yesterday, Rabbi. Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery.
Hello and welcome to Songs of Freedom. This is the fourth episode. I'm Matthew Bolin, and here with me as always is my co-host Leanna Fernandez.
Hello, hello! Long time no here, see?
Yes, one of those. Well, today we're going to talk about what I labeled the female politic, or rather, female singers and songwriters dealing with political subject, protest music emanating from female singers and songwriters, so on and so forth. We'll get to that in just a second. I wanted to give that since the last episode, there have been a couple of MTV updates that I just wanted to relay that I thought added as sort of an epilogue, at least, to that discussion. And maybe we could talk about that for just a minute before actually getting onto the main subject of today. The first thing was that we had gone back and forth about the fact that there was the Dan Savage special that was taking place, I think, the day of or the day after we recorded. And I was waiting to, I think I said that I was cautiously hopeful, if that, but I wanted to see if this was a one-time thing or whether or not MTV would be moving forward with similar things. And as it turned out, they actually hired Savage to do a 12-episode season called Savage U. So I was actually pleasantly surprised that they followed up with an actual program hosted by him.
Well, see, this is why sometimes I need to watch television, because I'm only now recalling the conversation about Savage doing the anti-bullying segment. I'm sorry that I missed that, and I didn't actually know that, that had taken off on MTV. It's great to hear that. I know that he most recently got in a little bit of hot water for having said something about, I guess, comparing people who identified as gay, but also voting Republican to drug addicts. Which is getting a little bit off topic for from our show, but... he got in a bit of hot water. He said that he really went down hard on, no pun intended, yeah, on Republican. Okay, so the GOP has some, I guess, organization called GO Pride or something like that.
There's also the Log Cabin Republicans. That's another like organization of gay Republicans.
I think he was specifically referring to this one group that I'm thinking about called GOP Pride.
Okay.
Oh, GOP Proud, actually. Okay. That's the name of the organization. And well, anyway, so he got in a bit of trouble because he pretty much said that they were self-loathing, damaged, and very much like a drug addict who just really couldn't possibly endorse this one thing that completely condemned them to die, among other things. And you know how contradictory that was, how hypocritical that was. But the only way you could be Republican and endorse Romney and be gay at the same time is if you hated yourself.
Mm.
Oh, now as I was talking about that, I was looking up exactly what got him in hot water. He called them house faggots.
Oh.
So he's definitely not known for subtlety.
No, it is still interesting. Even taking all that into account, that actually MTV would be actually willing to go forward with Savage with an actual sex education television show, especially in how we contrasted that, the idea of sex education, towards what seemed to be the glorification of unwed teen pregnancy in their Teen Mom show. And as an update with that, I heard that they currently they either currently just did or they're in the midst of broadcasting another season of that, but they stated that this would be the last season, at least with the current batch. Now, it left it a bit open as to whether or not they would go and find additional Teen Moms for the future, but it also did leave open to interpretation the idea that they were basically going to wrap up the idea in total of presenting the show, that once they were done with this season, they were done with Teen Mom.
Now, let me ask you a question, because the thing is, I feel like I'm not equipped to talk about this. And the reason is because I don't and have not watched television in eons, and certainly what TV I have watched has not been MTV for many years. So, I mean, I have a very cursory knowledge of what happens on Jersey Shore, on what happens even on the real world these days. What's your take? Are you optimistic that, the powers that be over that Viacom are actually trying to pull this in another direction? Are they taking the temperature of their audience and thinking, or are they trying to drive their audience to better views, to better viewing? Which do you think? Because I tend to think more cynically that this is all about the bottom dollar. And if they're not going to continue with the current lineup of anything, it's because the viewers aren't there to watch them. I mean, it's all about bread and circuses in my own mind, but that could be different from what other people are noticing the strategy to be. What's your take?
Well, considering that I think that of the two of us, I think you're the one who has the more optimistic take, and you're cynical about this. You should know the fact that when I crossed over a few years ago from general cynicism about society to borderline misanthropic attitudes, that I really feel that while I would like to, in my heart of hearts, believe that there's sort of an awakening of MTV, I think it probably has more to do with ratings. Much like how music tends to go in waves, I think so does programming. It basically deals with what is the audience that you're dealing with interested in. And while this particular generation, as it got older, could possibly identify to some extent whether or not they were Teen Moms or not with the characters on the screen, it seems to me that at this particular point in time, I heard another online critic, who goes by the name Todd in the Shadows, point out something very interesting. You know, recently, there was a really odd occurrence in Billboard charts where we had gone years and years without having anything that could be considered to be a rock band or a rock act have the number one song on Billboard's Hot 100. And then basically from April through June, between Fun's We Are Young and Goitier's, is that the pronunciation?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I think you're doing a good job.
Okay. Between Goitier's, between Fun and Goitier, we had for, I think, about 8 to 10 weeks, what would be considered, for all intents and purposes, rock acts with the number one song. But
nice.
Here's the thing. What Todd also pointed out was while he initially thought that this may be a change, a positive change, a trend towards maturity in popular music, the realization might actually be something quite the opposite, considering that right now the number one song is Call Me Maybe by Carly Rae Jepsen, and that...
Tell me about this song. I have only seen covers of it online.
It's basically what you would call an earworm. She basically is what you would call a Bieber disciple. She's another Canadian artist. She came in third in one of the years of Canadian Idol, which ran for 6 seasons, but doesn't run anymore. It's the first single off of her second album. Somehow, if Bieber did like a lip dub of it because he liked it so much, and then it took off in the States. And now everybody does. And it's sort of what you call an earworm, though even with that, I don't know if you would actually call it a good song. But what it does seem to represent, and what Todd in the Shadows pointed out, is that when you have that as the number one song, when you have these two new boy bands that are fighting it out, it might very well be that what he thought, and what I kind of agree with, that with Fun and Goitier, what seemed like a change might have been just a blip between one period of pop music and the next wave taking over. And the next wave when you have Bieber's most successful single coming, being the first track off of his first single off of his second album debuting last week at number one with nearly 400,000 copies sold, I think. These boy bands happening and the pop charts loaded with what seems to be the same sort of party music. It might be that the new wave actually is now happening, and it's another wave of basically Disney-friendly teen act, sort of. So it's basically a reintroduction of what was occurring about 10 years ago at this time.
You know, it's interesting because as you say that, and, you know, for anyone listening, I have not listened to much, if any, Top 40 radio or commercial radio since, I would say, the mid-90s. But every now and then, of course, you can. It's the inevitable. You right. hear bits and pieces of it just being out with friends, being out socially. And now even being online, a lot of the music that I actually tried very hard to avoid for many years is really pervasive. And, you know, this teaches you a lot about yourself. It teaches you a lot about your tolerance for certain genres and surprises you with what you might have thought wouldn't be appealing and is, and then you start to ask yourself all sorts of questions. I find that a lot of the music that I'm hearing, be it because I've been introduced to it through, I don't know, a video that's gone viral, or perhaps because a friend posted it online on Facebook or something, I find that there's a lot of earworms these days. And, you know, a lot of style before substance. And what comes to mind right now is, what's her name? Selena Gomez. I Love You Like a Love Song. And I think it's probably, you know, all I can think, and the only thing I can think of saying about that is it's a guilty pleasure. I can just, it seems so catchy, you know, like, yeah. I love you like a love song, baby. But and then I start to think, when was the last time I derived this kind of pleasure from something that didn't really seem to mean very much to me? I mean, in terms of depth, musical depth. Wow, I hate to name bands that I've had a lot of love for, but because then that would sound like a diss. But I can't really think of anything past, like, the early 80s. You know, or even the dawn of new wave. Or, yeah, I mean, I guess a few things come to mind. But, yeah, you know, it really doesn't have a lot of depth, and I feel at the same time that it's so catchy, and yet that seems to be the case with so many of these songs, and you're just describing that right now.
Yeah, it is true, and actually this would be a good transitional point, because when you talk about...
Exactly, I was hoping to catch that.
When you talk about Carly Rae Jepsen and then Selena Gomez, you sort of talk about, you know, what's the direction of female popular music nowadays, and I have sort of a contrast between, you get into the idea of what did Madonna represent versus what Lady Gaga now represents, and, you know, what the main differences were besides, you know, the obvious ripoffs of some image and some tunes by the latter versus the former, you know, how much is copying and how much is originality and what the true musical talent is of things like that. And then it brought me to the realization that actually for female music, this is actually a pretty good time, because you're seeing, you know, a lot, at least in the top of the chart, you are seeing these things like Carly Rae Jepsen and a big crossover by, you know, Nicki Minaj in the hip-hop world. And then, of course...
And I would interrupt, that you're also seeing, from the perspective of the elder artists, for instance, in this case, you've only mentioned Madonna, and I'm thinking specifically of her, and what seems to be a little bit of a rivalry with these younger women and her, call them her descendants musically, as much with Lady Gaga and their beef, because Madonna has more than hinted at the fact that she thinks that Lady Gaga is ripping her off.
Right.
But also, and in this case, I find her to be less justified, and this has been an argument that I've seen many sides of, her beef with M.I.A. after the Super Bowl halftime show, because M.I.A. flipped the bird, and
yeah.
Madonna goes and surprises everyone who has known everything about what she's done in her life before, by saying that she thought it was inappropriate. And that's a bit discordant given her history. And, you know, I definitely buy the argument that there's a tad bit of jealousy going on there, that Madonna has no right and no argument in this case, given what she has done and how she has rocked the boat in the music industry. Why is this pot calling the kettle black? And also seeing some of the more recent things that she's done in concert, for instance, I think it was in Serbia, she did a concert recently, and she, you know, pulled down her costume suggestively and, you know, gave everybody a nipple peek, and it just,
yeah,
I guess, reeked of desperation coming from Madonna. I mean, why is she doing this? Is this a desperate attempt at trying to grab some of the fame that she seems to have lost over the years with age and with the coming of new female symbols of liberation and of rebellion. I think that's all very valid. I think that how Madonna has, how shall we say, coped with this new generation of female pop divas is very telling of Madonna, but also very telling of the industry itself.
Well, the two things that I took from it regarding both Madonna's flashing performances in her tour, as well as her reaction to the MIA thing, it brought me back to a couple of things. The first one is that I think in Madonna's mind, perhaps, the big difference is the fact that with the MIA thing, this was something that Madonna didn't approve of. And with Madonna, it's about control. And
right.
It's about being able to be the person who is signing off on it, whether or not it was the religious imagery in the Like a Prayer video. You know, she didn't inform Pepsi that she was going to use the song that was going to be the centerpiece of the multi-million-dollar marketing campaign in her official video as all these things that would use all of these controversial Catholic imagery and get them to back out of the campaign within 24 hours' time. But she was pissed off with MIA flipping the bird, which she probably didn't even see during the course of the performance, but heard about afterwards. And
yep.
It was like, hey, I didn't sign off on that. If you're going to do something at my show, I need to know about this beforehand and say whether or not it's cool. And since you didn't, I'm going to go ahead and say it's not cool. And whereas, you know, she'll flash her boob in Serbia because that was her making a decision to flash a boob in Serbia. It really comes down to the fact that as an artist who has been in control of her career, it extends to the fact of her being the one determining how to shape it. And I think that extends to when you talk about the old guard versus the new guard. Madonna she's had a lengthy domination where I think that from her first album to her most recent album, she's had at least one top 10 hit over each one of them. And I think that extends back to 1984, which means that she's had a top 10 hit over a period of 28 or 29 years in a career span. And
mm-hmm.
It's really noticeable the fact that the top 10 hits from her last two albums have been the first time that she's released singles, I believe, where she had a much younger artist or artists as featured artists in order probably to boost the success of the track. Because with Hard Candy, the first single was 4 minutes with Justin Timberlake and Timbaland producing. And now the only success, I forget what the name of her most recent album is, but the first track on it she released from it contained Nicki Minaj and M.I.A. And
now let me ask you a question about that. What do you think, and I'm sorry if you were going to finish a point there, and we'll get back to it. What do you think that says about the artist and corporatism? Meaning, you phrased it as Madonna did not sign off on MIA flipping the bird. Had she signed off on it, then perchance this might have been okay with Madonna.
Right.
Madonna recruits young talent to help put her hits into the top 40, which implies that perhaps had she not done that, she might have had some concerns about it not making or not appealing to a younger audience. What do you think that speaks to in terms of the female pop star and corporatism, does it speak to anything? Do you think those two are related?
I think in terms of when you're looking at a pop star and you're looking at somebody who is sort of based upon the idea of, let me put it this way. Pop stars, I look at when they have things debut or songs, singles drop or stuff like that. People are looking at them and how they debut and how much they debut with along the same, in a similar vein to how they sort of look at opening weekend box office statistics.
Okay.
And I think that there's a difference between how pop music is marketed and pop not just in terms of a label on a genre of music, but pop in terms of popular, in terms of things that are expected to be in the top 10 of Billboard, whether on the album or the singles charts, and how there's a different type of marketing that goes into them versus, say, somebody who is also an elder statesman but looked as more of a, what you would call a vanity or a catalog act, in which the music is created, it comes out, it either is well-received and maybe becomes part of their canon, sort of along the lines of what happened with Dylan's comeback in 1997 and onwards.
Okay.
Versus somebody along the lines of, say, Madonna, or from a male perspective, maybe like the most recent Bon Jovi albums, where it becomes news of how well it's going to do. Or, you know, Michael Jackson was also sort of obsessed with sales numbers, even, you know, after not just his sales dipped downward, but everybody's sales dipped downward. It was the idea, how well are things going to debut, and not even as much about like what is the critical reception as what is the popular reception. And I think that fits into what the mindset is of still within major labels, who are still sort of driven by like sales marks and gold records on the wall, and the idea of creating success as much as creating legacies.
Even that mentality, wouldn't you call that passé? And it's passé for both genders, whether you're talking about female part of. But I would even argue that it's even less of an issue for women. And only because if we're going to look at the trajectory of female pop stars, and you just gave this great example of how the ground is currently ripe, be it Nicki Minaj or, well, MIA or any number of artists, to really reestablish themselves and even divorce themselves from that model, given the proliferation of MP3s and everything that we've talked about before. Wouldn't it even dig a deeper hole for the artists who came before, the old guard, to acknowledge themselves or to define themselves within those brackets?
It is really problematic. Especially when you consider the judgment that has passed, and you're right, the whole concept about things being passé, but unfortunately the record industry is still living in this passé model, where it's really hard for them not to look at things in terms of a tangible physical medium that you can sell in terms of units. I mean, they've been very slow to act upon the idea of crossing over from the default being a physical unit to a series of MP3s that are downloaded. But I mean, but when you're still dealing with something like an industry trade paper like Billboard, that still will make mention of the fact that, say, Beyoncé's 4 album is the most recent example of a album that came out after an album that had 3 or more top 10 hits and failed to produce a top 10 hit. Is that simply a female thing? No, but it is interesting that, I'm not 100% sure, but I do think that they did mention it in terms of she was the 3rd or 4th female artist for that to happen to. So they do break things down in the industry based upon not just genre, but by sex as well. And so it becomes an unavoidable topic. So the question then becomes, since it really still is an unavoidable topic, you know, exactly what is being done by artists when you still have that focus on you? And what I keep on coming back to is like a jumping off point, not even so much as what Madonna did over this past year or what's going on now with Nicki Minaj or Carly Rae Jepsen, is still trying to wrap my head around exactly what happened in these last 60 or so weeks since the release of Adele's 21. This was a sophomore album. Usually sophomore albums do all right, but don't always live up to the buzz of the original. Like, if you remember, Norah Jones' second album sold a pittance compared to her first, and she, like Adele, also won Best New Artist, and Adele won at least, I think, one other award besides Best New Artist when 19 came out. But the idea that this album, as heartbreak and relationship albums go, it's not the deepest or the most shocking thing to come out. A lot of them, the songs on it, are rather pretty straightforward. I mean, it's not Joni Mitchell's Blue by any means.
Sure.
But the fact that this album is going to, within the next few weeks, hit 10 million in sales just in the U.S., and it will be the first quote-unquote new album to do that since Usher's Confessions 10 years ago. That's how much the landscape has really changed.
Wow.
You know, it literally, considering what general sales are in albums nowadays, her selling 10 million albums is really, and actually it really does actually make sense. The fact is that she spent over the last year 24 non-consecutive weeks at number one with this album. The last act to do that was Prince with Purple Rain.
Wow.
Prince's Purple Rain sold in the U.S., I believe, and this is going to be like my Dire Straits thing, where I guessed one that thing and it was off.
I was going to say, you've done your homework.
It was, but it was still off by, I think, a factor of two or three. I do know that when Prince was at number one for 24 weeks with Purple Rain, that old album sold closer to 20 million copies than 10. But in today's market, her selling 10 million copies in America of an album is pretty close to selling 20 million or more copies would have been even just a decade ago. That's how much things have changed. And it's the fifth greatest selling album in British history. It literally is, she actually had, and it's not just the album sales. She's had three number one songs. Between them, they lasted a total of 14 weeks at number one. That means that between the album and the singles charts, she was number one on at least one of them for 38 weeks. That is something that only a couple of other albums in history have had, that type of combination of crossover in terms of number ones. And at one point, she became, I think right after she won a bunch of Grammys in February, and the two earlier singles bounced back up to the top 10, she became, I think, the first act since the Bee Gees during Saturday Night Fever to have three separate songs in the top 10 at the same time. The question, I mean, this goes beyond just the concept of the female, the idea of Adele as a female artist, but it does really seem to me that, if anything, it would seem that if something becomes really, really popular, it seems that within a matter of months, there are nowadays the rapidity at which media goes, that there are forms of imitators that show up. And
absolutely, I think that was definitely the case with Amy Winehouse.
Yeah, but the thing is, and it was true in Britain, the fact that there was this retro female soul revival, that all these artists were being signed around the same time.
Yep.
With Amy and with Adele and with Duffy and with Lily Allen. The thing is, at least here in America, in the record industry, I haven't heard anything coming in the wake of Adele which is sort of like Adele. The closest thing that's happened to it has been the release of Fiona Apple's latest album after that was held back for a couple of years. But that's not a new act.
Not at all. And that's actually getting huge, huge press. And I haven't heard it. Full Disclosure.
I haven't heard of Full Disclosure either, but also the type of reviews it's getting, you think that it has magical healing powers.
Absolutely. I mean, it's getting more buzz even than, we were talking about her in an earlier, Let England Shake. Talk about an album. That's another album that came out this year that was extremely powerful, female soloist, who is certainly not a novelty act.
Right.
And is also being credited, with having this phenomenal record.
Right.
Being kind of in a well-seasoned career. So it does beg the question of what the audience in America really wants to hear versus what they're getting.
Yeah, and that's really the thing that got me. And we can jump off from the idea of the artist as a political thing, because unlike Madonna, I don't feel that Adele is promoting anything of sex as politics. It's simply
at least not with that album.
At least not with that album. We'll see what happens, but considering the fact that she's about to get engaged and she's pregnant, and we just found this out in the last couple of weeks, I'd wonder how the post-baby album actually will sound compared to 21.
Well, she's actually alluded to that even before the baby. I have to look it up, but I think she said something along the lines of she's boring now and she's very happy and she doesn't think she could record this album again.
She did state even when she came up with 21 that she didn't want to title the album a number, but it was just because it felt like an extension of motifs that she had started on the previous album that she ended up like this, and that she wanted to get away from it for her third album. And let's see by the time that actually comes out whether or not that does occur. The real question, though, is that in my mind is, like I said, when there's a big hit of proportions, like when Nirvana hit, everybody was signing anything that sounded like grunge. When NSYNC and Backstreet Boys hit, you had this whole wave of look-alike, sound-alike boy bands coming. And it seems that even with Bieber, we're seeing the results of his influence in terms of other acts being signed and promoted. Yet with Adele, who's had the biggest album of the last quarter century when measured on the statistics that I've just given, she is still, more than a year after its release, a unique occurrence. The examples that I gave, of what's come in her wake that's in any way similar is a album by Fiona Apple is an album by an older artist that actually was probably finished before 21 came out and was actually held back. So the question is, what is it, maybe about Adele, but also about mature female artists that doesn't seem to drive things in the way that other recent successes have with boy bands, with grunge? Even, it seems that with female artists, if there are copycat artists that come out, we're looking at other, like, teen artists, like Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera, both being former Mouseketeers who had their debut albums come out within about a year of themselves and being intertwined with one another, and then other artists like them, like Mandy Moore and such, having their first albums come out around the same time. Why is it that that occurs, but something which seems feminine and mature is not having the same type of search and promotion for the next version of such and such?
I think I have an answer. I'll take a crack at an answer. When we discuss Britney, Christina Aguilera, I would add to that category, although obviously a much younger generation, Miley Cyrus.
Right.
I see a sexualization of the music. Even Madonna, I think, has, or we can even say, or I would say if you were going to draw some kind of family tree, that Madonna really did open that door, and that was just one manifestation of what Madonna did. Which is not to say that I would put Madonna in that category, like Madonna was only about fetishizing this young, nubile woman, because clearly that's not the case. But I think that there is a kind of divisiveness in terms of what the public has accepted or has come to expect of its female vocalists and artists. On one side of the equation, you have the artists, you have the, shall we say, the more intellectual musician. And on the other side of that equation, you have the more sexualized version. I think when you have a more sexualized version, whether that be a young version of Madonna or a very, you know, overtly sexual version of Madonna, like Madonna during Erotica, all the way down to Miley Cyrus, that has a very broad commercial appeal for pretty obvious and, I should say, pretty base reasons. And then on the other side of that equation, you've got these, as you call them, mature female artists, who within themselves can be quite divisive. Because whether you're talking about the lead singer Saint Etienne having a very different sound from Fiona Apple, these are women who, or even a Joni Mitchell if you want to go even further back, they have their own niche, they have their own driven, specific, smaller micro audiences, and they cater to very specific tastes. I would not necessarily pin a Kate Bush fan for a Fiona Apple fan, or even necessarily an Adele fan. Yet I would still say that under a very broad quilt, those are mature women who are not interested in being fetishized, or who certainly don't move or promote that in themselves so much as their vulnerability. And perhaps that's the difference. It's something between sexuality versus vulnerability and how they're dealt with and to what extent people, these artists, actually put one over the other. I suppose that's polarizing, but that's how I see it.
Yeah. I think the one difference that really stands out to me between Madonna and the generation that came after her has to do with two things: age and self-control. Age in terms of the fact that Madonna was in her 20s when her debut album came out. She had basically pounded the streets as a photographer's model, as a drummer and guitarist in underground bands like the Breakfast Club in New York, a dancer, things like that. And she was somebody who built up from her experience the idea of knowing the power of sexuality and using that almost as a form of not just a way to get her become popular, but as a message of self-expression, even political expression in some ways. On the other hand, when you take a look, when Britney Spears came out, they literally made her jailbait for her first video.
That's true.
And
I mean, you know, yeah, no, go on.
No, and so the idea, it just seems to me that in terms of that type of progression, here's the other thing. The one thing that's actually changed is we've gone from having Madonna, who's in her 20s, doing these things which are sexualized but do have a definition of what I would consider to be maturity to them, of control and not just femininity but womanliness, to these teenagers acting as though they're older than they are by this almost flaunting of sexuality. And this what kind of scared me. Carly Rae Jepsen, who I mentioned earlier, is where we are now with Call Me Maybe. If you check her out in the video, she's got these pigtails, she's got these high school guys as her band behind her. She's trying to be seductive to this guy who looks like he's maybe in college, but comes off as the older guy who she's really hot for. Carly Rae Jepsen is 26 years old, and she's being portrayed as though she's 10 years younger than her actual age.
Now you made me intrigued to watch the video. You know, in all of this, another word comes to mind: submission.
Yeah.
Let's look at some artists that are female and are not submissive. And in that, we get, I would put in that category L7. I would put in that category Liz Phair.
Mm-hmm.
I would certainly put in that category Karen Finley, Tales of Taboo. So these are artists that do not, oh, Bikini Kill, big one. Talk about artists that, oh, Peaches. There's another one that I would definitely put in that category.
Yeah, I would say that Peaches. I would say that Peaches is more the modern definition, a descendant of Madonna, even more than Lady Gaga is.
Wow, I don't know about that. I mean, I could see how she's, again, if you look at Madonna as the roots of a tree, and that's the only way that I can visualize it right now without much time to put it into words. She's one manifestation, but I don't see too many people following in her footsteps. I mean, obviously, Amanda Palmer has recorded with her, and I would definitely put her in that category. L7, I think, falls closer to that.
I was looking along the lines of what the type of music that Peaches is doing and what she's sort of saying versus in combination of Lady Gaga, who uses much more in the way of terms of performance art and has, I would say, except, you know, with the exception of the tracks like Born This Way, which is just a straight ripoff, has actually done things which are, has done a lot more in of non-dance material than somebody along the lines of, say, Peaches or even...
Yeah, but here's the thing about Peaches, and this is where I differ. I think that's not quite like Madonna. Madonna, in some of her tracks, and I'm thinking, again, like A Prayer or La Isla Bonita, there is a certain ingenue quality to it. There is a submissive quality to it. It's the lovelorn woman who isn't quite in control. I have never heard a Peaches tune where she seemed to manifest that at all. Nor would I say, of course, the same of Karen Finley or Lydia Lunch or L7 or any number of artists who have, or whether it's, or Liz Phair. I mean, Liz Phair, well, actually, that's not true. I take that back. Liz Phair does show some vulnerability, but there's a different twist to it. It's not, I think, catering towards a male erotic fantasy of, I can't help myself but love you.
Yeah.
Or want you. There's more of a raw, bestial, carnal urgency to the wording, to the verbiage, to the lyricism, to the impulse that drives that music.
I will say this, though, in terms of Madonna, it is interesting. You bring up the idea of the submissive with La Isla Bonita, and I will say that it does say something about Madonna's actual complexity within her career, or at least the first half of her career, where I think she was as much focused on the quality of the music rather than just the idea of the promotion of herself as a legend or an entity or something like that. That True Blue, the album where La Isla Bonita is from, kicks off with Papa Don't Preach, which is a really complex song when you look at it in terms of the idea of self-control versus Catholic upbringing and the idea of the conflict between the pro-choice and the pro-life aspects of things and the idea that she's singing it to her father, but she's the one in control the entire time.
Yes, but ultimately that song is about the need for male validation because she talks about what she needs right now is a little advice, and she needs his blessing right now. So, to me, that's still relinquishing something.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at something like Pick a Bikini Kill song, or if you look at even something like, okay, taking it totally apart, Liz Phair and Divorce Song.
Yeah.
Let's not even go to HWC or Flower or any of the more sexualized songs that are obviously not in that vein. something like Divorce Song, where she admits in a very raw and carnal way to have been hurt and being alone. But in that singing, I find such a release. She doesn't ask for help. She's lost it all. She's rock bottom, and now all she's doing is emoting the fact that she is completely independent, whether that be an independence she sought or not, is almost besides the point. To me, it's about her declaring she's alone. And when I look at Madonna, I agree with you in that the song is extremely complex, that she's dealing with very, very, even now, socially charged issues. And she's to be lauded for that. But at the end of the song, it's still about wanting the support from someone. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah, I would say that Divorce is declarative, and it's basically, in terms of the fact that it really does state the idea that it basically says what the problem is when you actually are dealing with the concept of the male control or the male superior, and the idea of specific roles that have been expected to exist in terms of a relationship, in terms of, yeah, like you said, Madonna is asking for advice from her father in the song, whereas in the Divorce Song, Liz Phair points out that the declarative statements that are coming from the husband or the ex-husband in the course of the song are just so much bullshit if there's not an actual level of understanding and equality that's involved in it. I think the most emotional part of the song for me has always been the lines that go, "You put in my hands a loaded gun and then told me not to fire it. When you did the things you said were up to me and then accused me of trying to fuck it up."
Exactly. I mean, there's a reason that album is so genius, and that she was so destroyed for having come out with that self-titled monstrosity later. But okay.
It basically is, she's sort of, if you want a male equivalent, it's sort of like how Robbie Robertson was, in terms of the fact that the first two albums by the band were pure genius, and then everything else like that felt pretty mediocre to me and to a lot of people in comparison. And it might be very well that she's just somebody who had a particular size wad and she blew it almost all at once.
So but speak. See, I worry about Adele being like that.
Where I don't worry so much about Adele is the fact that actually I think 21 was an improvement over 19, whereas even between Exile and Guyville and Whip Smart, there was a downgrade between the second album and the first. And a lot of the good stuff that was on Whip Smart came from pre-Exile stuff anyways. I mean, there was stuff from both albums which came from Girly Sounds.
Yeah, from Girly Sounds.
This is Matthew, and I'm recording a little tag for this production, as we had so much material that we are going to be splitting this podcast into two sections. So this ends the first section of the podcast on women and music and the politics of sex. And episode 5, which will be the second part of our discussion, should be posted in the next week or two. So until then, this is Matthew Bolin speaking for myself and my co-host Leanna Fernandez, saying thanks very much for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon. Good night.
I was flying into Chicago at night, watching the lake turn the sky into blue-green smoke. The sun setting to the left of the plane, and the cabin was filled with an unearthly glow. 2070.